I reside in Denton County, Texas. I represent the petitioner, Jimmy Vincent and others, realtors in the court below. This case is a dispute over the constitutionality of certain portions of the tax code. It arose, the Vincent case versus Burgess case, arose out of Denton County, where in 1986, a group of taxpayers passed a petition calling for a tax rollback in accordance with the provisions of Section 2607 of the tax code. It was duly submitted timely to the Commissioner's Court of Denton County. The Commissioner's Court made a return that they were unable to find that sufficient numbers of qualified taxpayers had signed the petition. A writ of mandamus was brought to set aside that and to force the election. The Court of Appeals in Fort Worth on four points of error that were alleged by the realtors below petitioners here found against the county commissioners and found that the system used was unreasonable, unfair, and also a violation, I believe, of the Voting Rights Act. The court on rehearing filed by Mr. Luna, representing the respondents in the case, alleging that the provisions of 2607 of the tax code were unconstitutional, cited the opinion of the Attorney General to that effect, citing sections, Article 8, Section 1A, and Article 8, Section 9 of the Texas Constitution, and found the act to be unconstitutional. We filed a motion for rehearing. It was denied, and the case has arrived here on a petition for writ of mandamus. I'm denominated as the petitioner, having not prevailed in the Civil Appeals Court of Fort Worth. Mr. Ron Johnson is also denominated as a petitioner here, although he prevailed in the Winborn versus Ellis County Commissioner's case. So for the sake of aligning the parties, we're now properly aligned. The position that we have taken in this cause is that the provisions of Section Article 8, Section 1A, and Article 8, Section 9 are not in conflict with the provisions of the tax code. Now, the reason that we've, as we've set forth in the brief, is that the Bill of Rights on Article 1, Section 2, and Article 1, Section 27 gives the people of this state the right to gather together and by petition alter and change their government. Article 1, Section 29 of the Constitution says that these rights are inviolate, that they're accepted from the general powers of government, and that government may not diminish them. Now, I don't think I have found any cases where we've had exactly this issue appear before. The Court of Appeals says that the provisions of Article 8, Section 1A, for very particular, Article 1A allows the commissioners to tax an environmental tax as limited to a certain rate. Article 8, Section 9, states that they have the right to set the tax rate to provide for the court constitutional. Now, my position that Article 1, Section 29 accepts out from the general powers of government the right to prevent the citizens from petitioning and holding an election. Now, we have had the cases hold that you have, as a governmental official, to give the right to be heard on petition, where there is no litigation, or not litigation, but legislation to enforce these provisions of the Bill of Rights. We also know that these rights are self-activated. We do not have to have some legislation to put them into force. But here, we have legislation that furthers and puts into force these rights guaranteed in Article 1, Section 2 and Article 1, Section 27.
Is the right seeking to be exercised in this case in the nature of initiative and referendum?
I don't think it is. I think the right to be exercised here is the Article 1, Section 2 right to amend your government, as it says in Article 1, Section 2, amend it, abolish it, and change it. I think the initiative is close, but I think that the Article 1, Section 2 right is different because I think that when this was framed some 87 years after the adoption of the United States Constitution after a rather bloody civil war, the idea of apparently with the adoption of Article 1, Section 29 there, that the Constitution is not just what's written there, but the inherent inalienable rights of people that are that are more than there than just what we see written on the page. I think that's what they were working at. So I think there's more to it than that.
Is it your position that the people could call for a rollback, as they have in this case, without statutory authorization?
I think they could, yes. I don't think anybody would be required to act on it, you see. I don't think that without the statutory enactment that they could have a tax rollback.
You think they could or couldn't?
I do not think they could without this enactment. I think they'd have the absolute right to petition for it. Now, whether the government did it or not is another question, but without this legislation, I do not think they'd have the right to have a rollback. The position, quite frankly, that I take, is that this provision of Article 1, Section 2, and provision of Article 1, Section 27, are given a higher degree of enforcement and are accepted out of the power of any commissioner's court to prevent the rollback being done because of the enabling legislation that's been done in furtherance of those particular provisions, and they are held to a higher degree of standard than the general provisions of government here. If that's the proper way to phrase it, I'm not certain that's right, but it's certainly they're paramount over there. The other portion of it is that the particular provisions, Article 1, Section 2, provides that people have the right to gather together and change it. Article 1, Section 27 says come together by petition. Now, in Article 8, Section 9, the last phrase, which was quoted in the Winborn case, was that this was not a restriction on the provision of counties. The term counties is used. It's not a restriction on counties. And counties really wasn't defined there as commissioner's court. Above it, they use the term commissioner's court in this particular article. But at the last sentence says this shall not be a restriction on counties. In the Winborn case, they said, well, the counties must of necessity include the voters. And I think there is some case law to support that when a person organizes an election, that they are, in fact, an official of the state. And I've quoted the court from Justice Frankfurter, Terry versus Adams, talking about what is state action, which I judge state action to be who is a state officer or actionable person under the constitutional laws of the state. He says they don't have to be vested with the trappings of power, the oaths of office and what have you, but must exercise the power of government. And to find state action, of course, there had to be something there set forth in state government. Well, obviously, the right to petition for changing your government puts into effect this state action. I've also cited to the court a number of cases, Holt versus Bagley, Holt versus Trantham. The Holt versus Trantham case is the Trantham, and it's a very familiar person to me. Frankly, I screwed up in a case and it wound up in the Court of Appeals on the issue of whether or not the right to vote could be denied to voters, because each of these petitioners are voters and taxpayers. They're not the people who circulate the petitions, they're people who sign. But whether or not the right to vote could be denied based upon the mistakes made by election organizers, which in effect is the government official, whether it's a very formal set out or whether it's a person who passes a petition to call an election. And the Holt versus Trantham case was decided that an error on the part of a person who's organizing cannot be used to deny the right to vote. So I think we do have a good deal of case law to back up that a person who circulates a petition is in effect a state officer or a county officer in this case, because it was limited to a county area. So I think that provision, that was Article 8, Section 9, saying this is not a limitation on counties, is very applicable here, and quite well stated in the Winborn case. And that is essentially where we stand with regard to the Bill of Rights. Now, there's another provision of this, and that's Article 8, Section 21. Now, this is important from the standpoint that I believe that this authorizes the tax rollback provisions. And this is a very broad statement contained in the Texas Constitution. And it begins by saying that subject to any exception prescribed by general law, the total amount of taxes may not be raised in a succeeding year and so on, by paraphrasing, but subject to any exception unless it's advertised. Then the next sentence says that the legislature, by legislation, may define what is this hearing, the rules for it, the conduct of it. Now, the election code may mean a public hearing. So may the provision of the tax code for a rollback may well be a portion of a public hearing. The subject to any exception, in my judgment, the legislature could make any legislation it wanted in that. It doesn't require a finding like under the 13th or 14th Amendment in order to enforce the 13th or 14th Amendment that we have to repeal certain amounts of the 11th Amendment impliedly by this legislation. It allowed them to say, we're going to make an exception. And they could make an exception saying, tax increase, we define what a tax increase is, for instance. Then they could do that by defining a tax increase. That's part of the rules they could make. But they could say, we could find that any tax increase over $1, or any budget increase over $1, would just go into effect without any advertising, and that would be well within that. And what they've done with the tax code is they have said, before you put it into play, and if it exceeds 8%, you may do that, except that the people may pass a petition and call a referendum, and if that referendum is in your favor, then you may have that tax and keep it there. If not, then it is down at 8%. And I think that's well justified in Article 8, Section 21. It's a very broad-ended proposition, but I suggest to you that a reading of that thing says any exception that the legislature wants to make, and we've just opened the door to what the legislature wants to do. To interpret Article 8, Section 21 in any other way would be limiting the plain language of it. And it doesn't have any limit. That's the problem. And it gives them a vast range of expression. I think they've exercised it. It's our position that on the basis of both of these provisions in the Bill of Rights and on this Article 8, Section 21, that this rollback provision in the tax code is constitutional. That's all the issues are here. If there is no provisions in Article 8, Section 1A or Article 8, Section 9, prevented, it is a constitutional act. The rest of the brief and argument here, I think, deals with the methodology of how we get to that issue. I think it's a ripe issue, and it is one that we spent a great deal of time talking about. All the lawyers in this case have spent a great deal of time talking about it, and we all have very strong positions on it. That's why it's here. If there's no other questions, I'll turn my time over to Ron Johnson, who is the representative of Mrs. Winborn from Ellis County.
May it please the court, Mr. Ron B. Johnson, representing Maryland and Winborn.
Your Honor, it's my pleasure to address you. My first opportunity to be here since being sworn in this room some 21 years ago. Thank you for the opportunity. I'm pleased to have my client, Marilyn Winborn, present in the courtroom. Marilyn is an independent business lady in Ellis County and the daughter of a very distinguished attorney, Lynn Griffith, of Ellis County. I will address the issues of Mr. Trantham in two ways. One, an analogy that I would like to use, and secondly, to look at the experience in Ellis County. My analogy first would be on the issue of the argument by the county commissioners that they have the within the constitutional provision for taxes, that they have the exclusive right to set the tax rate. To them, I would say, where did you get that exclusive right? And to me, they come back and say, we got it in this article of the Constitution. And in there it says, we shall set the rate and it's to be effective for the year. My understanding of the constitutional tax provisions was that we the people had the power and nobody had the right to tax us until we adopted a constitutional amendment giving the rascals the right to tax us. And when we did that, being cautious, we said we're going to put a limitation on how much they can tax us. And that's the purpose of the constitutional amendment. And of course, somebody had to adopt it, so the natural thing was to the county commissioners would set it. Now, my analogy is if I go out and buy an automobile for one of my children, and we negotiate over it, and I'm the constitutional authority, and they talk me into a car that goes 120 miles an hour, and they wanted one that goes 150, but we finally said 120. In this case, we had a tax rate. If the spigot would only allow so many dollars per hundred. When I see them going down the street 100 miles an hour, am I without authority to do something about it? Can they look at me and say, I've got this car, I have the exclusive authority to go 120 miles an hour because that's how I got it. And I think that's the argument I'm hearing. We have the exclusive authority. We can go up 40% this year. We can kick it back to 1% next year. We can keep you, the taxpayers, doing like this. Or by golly, we can go to the end of the spectrum and run it flat out, and you can't do anything about it. I disagree with that.
You can vote them out of office.
Sir?
Vote them out of office when their election time comes up.
That is one remedy that may take us 4 years to do, but why should I have to do that? I didn't
My point is, you're not without a remedy.
Not without a remedy. But their argument is they have the exclusive right to set it. I'm saying it doesn't say that. We didn't give them that. Why can't the taxpayers set additional limitations that says, look, this year, in any one year, you're not going to turn on the spigot full blast. Now, Judge Thomas raised the issue asked me the question, was this procedural or substantive? And I suppose it depends upon what year you're talking about. In the totality of it, you could argue it's procedural matters. It's a matter of not turning the spigot too much. In the year that you put a limitation on it, it perhaps is substantive. I personally think the issue, real gut issue, is we didn't give up the right to put additional limitations on the taxing authorities by setting a basic constitutional taxing vehicle in place. That's the argument I would make on that. As to the right of petition and the Bill of Rights position, I would ask that you look at our experience in Ellis County. What happened? We went out and got the petition together. We could have, without legislation, we could have presented a petition, but we were given guidance by the legislature in a type of petition. We went out and got 6,000 signatures. I say we, I'm being overly expansive. Ms. Winberg, my client, and a lot of other hard-working individuals went out and got 6,000 signatures, took it to the county commissioners the way it was to be done, and Denton County had the advantage. At least they looked at their signatures. In our case, they could totally ignore it. They took it in this hand, placed it on this shelf, and took no action. Now, I guess the good side of that coin is the Act provides if they don't take any action, then it's all presumed the signatures are right, and so all those issues went out the board. What we presented is, as without question of law, complies with the legislative provisions for presentation of that petition. But they ignored us. And when it went to district court, nobody bothered, the council showed up, the committee members showed up. We went to the Court of Appeals, Ms. Winburn's always been there, and the other county commissioners showed up, and I'm going to make a point. And the point of it is, that's the problem when Mr. McLaughlin has argued in the past, well, sure you got a right to petition, but we don't have to do anything about it. Well, what's the big deal about the Bill of Rights then? And why do we spend so much time arguing about it? And why did the forefathers fight for these particular Bill of Rights that includes the right to petition? And in my ability to grapple with this problem that I've got this great right, but everybody's ignoring me. Why did they ignore me? King John responded to the barons, and I finally figured out, well, the reason he responded was they had a broadsword and they would hit him upside the head with it. And then I'm saying, well, these guys are not responding to me. Why? And the obvious answer is I don't have a broadsword. And where did it go? The Attorney General took it away from me.
Could you petition for the rollback without the statutory authority?
Yes. I believe you could. Now, let me explain to you why. What I think happened, though, in reality, I have the right to petition. And carrying my analogy of a broadsword forward, where did the right of petition come from? Where did we get this concept of petition? Well, it's the way civilized people finally decided to do their business. Instead of running off to battle, first they go to the opposing party and petition them, or to the authority figure and petition. That's a more civilized way. Well, you used to back up your petition with a weapon. And we became more civilized. And the civilized way is our referendum, our voting, our election of it. Now, where do we... The legislature defines my sword for me. And you say, where do you get the right for them to do it? Because I conceive it. Our government, it belongs to us if we've given it away. Petition belongs to us. We didn't give it away. I can conceive an election to support my petition, and the legislature will define my broadsword of referral, of referendum, I mean. If I make it too short, it doesn't get the job done. If I make it too big, then everybody's running down there all the time having referendums. And obviously, it has to be legislatively defined. That's where I get that right.
Without the statute, though, could you do what you're trying to do now?
Without the statute, I could petition. But I would have only remedies I would have to carry out my, to make my first, the Bill of Rights right effective would be either to shout or to run down the streets in anarchy. And so if you petition, nobody listens, that's all you got. So, yeah, I got to write a petition, but it wouldn't be an effective position. And I think my argument and the point of this extensive carrying on is the constitutional protected right to petition. If you say I've got to go get it, and it's my understanding from opposing counsel that there's some amendments in the legislature hopper over there, one of which is a broad referendum initiative type legislation. But why do I have to go there and get it? If our government says it belongs to me unless I gave it away, where did I give it away? I have the right to petition. I have the right to an effective petition. And my legislative representatives have defined my sword for me. And I have gone to use it. And I have not been effective because the Attorney General issued an opinion saying it's unconstitutional. And I don't believe there's any basis for that. And I believe that I have the right to have the election, which is why we're here. We are still waiting for our election. I believe I'm in the position that if you recognize that civil government best works with reason, if you say I have a right to petition, then you must say I have a right to an effective petition. And if you don't want me to shout, and if you don't want me to run down the streets, then you'd have to say that my legislative representatives have acted reasonably in creating the effective way to make my petition heard, and that I don't have to go get anybody else to create that for me, and that I don't have to have a constitutional amendment. Why should I have to have a constitutional amendment? It already exists.
Is there any other area of the Constitution that could be changed by petition?
I think you could say to me, Lawyer Johnson, you're now proposing a way in which everybody can go change everything, and I think that you're right. Now, would it happen that way? Well, first off, the legislature has to define and the sword or the method by which it's going to happen. And there are going to be considerations.
Do you say they have to define?
Unless they do, you have no way to get to
them. Where is it in the Constitution, then, that the legislature has to?
No, they don't have to. That was a misstatement. They may. If they don't, then, again, my right to petition is merely paper. It means nothing. You could have left it out of the Bill of Rights. It means nothing. But I think any issue is subject to a petition and a referendum, meaning the voting part to me. But my legislative representatives are have to create, in each instance, the right way to do it.
They create the referendum part, the voting part?
They create the proper bounds. In other words, in our instance, it was a certain percentage of voters out of the last election.
But there are no bounds to the petition itself.
No. No. Only reason. The legislature may think that particularly if I take a petition to my legislator and say I want you to create a referendum on this, they may think that's a foolish one. Fail to act. Therefore, I don't have it. But that's okay. Well, you may end up with cases saying whether in this particular instance the sword of referendum which was created is either too short or too big. And those would be issues for you to decide.
But didn't the voters back there when they wrote the Constitution and set up the terms of the legislature for 2 years.
Correct.
Didn't they have that in mind, that if that legislature wasn't responsive, then in a short time they could get one that would be responsive? That's the reason why they gave 2-year terms?
I'm sure that's correct, that wouldn't help us where we got somebody sitting there saying it's unconstitutional, you got to have a constitutional amendment to change this. And I got a right to go to that legislature every 2 years to ask them to create a method whereby my petition will be heard under the Bill of Rights.
But don't you have a right to go to the commissioners every year to get something done about tax rate?
I have a right to go. I have that remedy, but I don't believe it's my only remedy. And commissioners are elected for 4 years, I believe, and they rotate. But
yes, but the budget is set
annually. And if they enter into a process of jumping me 33% 1 year and jumping me 2% the next year and then back to 40%, I have a right to go to them. But if they don't do it, I believe that I have another remedy. And obviously, the groundswell for it didn't begin in Ellis County. The issue is before you because there has been a pronounced need for it, whether it was brought on by high inflation, whether it was brought on by too much government, spending too much money, is not really the issue. The issue is whether we have to wait for a constitutional amendment to give us the right of referendum, or whether we already have it because we never gave it away as Texas citizens. And in our position, we never gave it away. There have been a procedure adopted for it. Thank you. I appreciate your time.
The court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
May it please the court, Mr. Earl Lubin will be representing Big Burger for the
Peace Court. I'd like to follow up on some of the things that the two counsel have indicated here in their argument. But first, I'd like to go back to the way this case came up. In the Ellis County part of it, on October 1st, 1986, Commissioner's Court set tax rate. And under the method of calling the election, they had a total of maximum of 200 days to call that election. If had there been an election, the election would have been April 19th of 87, but it filed a little early, so April 11th of 87 would have been the day for an election, had there been an election. Now, I say that to get in focus that this statute has been amended effective January 1, 1988. But in areas that are not material as far as this case is concerned. The amendment doesn't have any significance to the things before this court. But then what the plaintiffs are, the appellants here, petitioners, are asking that this court do, actually, is by a decision favorable to them, save the petitioners the usual problems that we have in getting something done, to wit, going to the legislature or taking the other route and getting the Constitution amended. The effect of what they're doing is asking this court to save them of that problem and asking this court to amend the Constitution for them. The reason we think that they are clearly doing that is that the courts have unanimously held, and even the amicus curiae, as well as the petitioners themselves, quote a number of cases that hold that the court should look at all of the Constitution, and not just one part of it, should look at all of it and give effect to all portions of it and harmonize it if it can. In this case, we think that it's clear that it can be harmonized. And the part they're asking, though, in order not to harmonize it, for the court to strike out and in effect repeal, is that part of Article 8, Section 9, which provides that once the court has levied the annual tax rate, the same shall remain in force and effect during that taxable year. Now, in order to give effect to that portion of the Constitution in order for it to remain in effect for the remainder of that taxable year, Article 2607, which provides for a rollback election of the taxes that year, just flat is in conflict with the Constitution itself. Now, this statute came up when we were doing a lot of revising of the tax code, and this is and it's different for counties than it is for school districts and others. Now, this statute, in this rollback statute, it applies, as you know, the other statute applies to school districts. This one applies to cities, counties, and others. And I think counties are even in a different categories than perhaps cities and others who are under this statute. Different from schools, because the rollback statute on schools doesn't roll it back, but it limits it next year. This one rolls back the current year. Yet school districts and city councils are not in the same area under the Constitution as counties are. The Constitution does not say, for example, that school boards will meet at a certain time and set a tax rate, and that shall be the tax rate for the remainder of the year. The Constitution doesn't say that about schools or about other cities, hospitals, and municipalities. But it does say it about counties, so that puts them in a different position from others. And maybe the reason, one of the reasons that the legislature or that the people adopted this kind of a statute is that they realized that we're going to have through the legislature certain mandated expenditures for counties that the legislature would mandate that they spend. And once the tax rate was set for those expenditures, including the mandated ones, then maybe there should not be a rollback, and perhaps that's the reason the Constitution was written the way it was, and hence 2607 being in violation of that constitutional provision would be unconstitutional. Now, there's just no way that we can see that we can give effect to that part of the Constitution and 2607 be constitutional. Now, one of the council raises question, where do they get the authority to set the tax rate? Obviously, they get it from the people who put it in the Constitution and required the Commissioner's Court to set that tax rate. Now, does that affect the people's right under the Bill of Rights? Of course not. The people could go to the legislature and get a constitutional amendment submitted and could get a vote on it. And if, in fact, the people wanted to change the constitutional amendment, they could amend Article 8, Section 9 and make it say exactly what council advocates that it ought to say. But that's the way to do it. And there is a method. And certainly he could submit a petition, but it would be like in a matter that is not before this court. If a large number of people submitted a petition to this honorable court, chances are this court wouldn't take any action on it if it was not connected with some sort of evidence that was otherwise before the court. But there is a method. There is a method that information can get before this court as evidence in a lawsuit that properly gets you. Now, his petition in this case, certainly one good time, he can submit it any time he wants to, but one good time to have submitted it would have been in the public hearing that is required by the legislature, that before the tax rate is set, and there was a public hearing, and they don't contest that, before the tax rate was set, they could take the petition to the members of the Commissioner's Court and ask them to please consider, here's petition and here's what we want you to do is not to set this tax rate. And being representatives of the people. Of course, any elected official is going to give some weight to that. They might or might not always be able to grant that petition, but as was pointed out earlier, if they did not grant it, there's an election coming up, and some of them are up for election every year. And they can remove those commissioners and put somebody in there who will carry out the will of the people. So the Bill of Rights is quite intact, and it's quite intact and it's quite in harmony with Article 8, Section 9 of the Constitution. There is a method of doing it. There is a method for them to get whatever relief that the people generally want. Now, it may be, in fact, that the people generally are in agreement with what the Commissioner's Court did on these two occasions. At least, if they want to change the procedure, the method is to go to the legislature and get the constitutional amendment submitted, as we said earlier. And if the members of the legislature who represent them don't submit it, they, of course, have a remedy of removing those members of the legislature and getting somebody in there who will vote for a constitutional amendment if they want to do away with Article 8, Section 9. But we simply submit that asking this court to nullify that key provision of Article 8, Section 9 is not appropriate. We cite
in the amicus brief of the Texas Association of Concerned Taxpayers, they list a number of elections, rollback elections, in the last 7 years. Why is this issue of the constitutionality just being raised after 16-some elections? Got any insight on that?
Well, I can't answer that question as to why, but it has been raised in a number of areas. As far as I know, the Denton County case is the first case that was filed where the constitutionality of it was raised. I'm not familiar with the details of
that. And it was sort of raised belatedly. Was that?
Oh, no, sir. No, it was.
Is it the Ellis County case that was raised belatedly? Yeah. One of them was raised on rehearing in the Court of Appeals.
Yeah, but that was Denton County. Let me tell you how that happened. We raised it in the trial court. We raised the constitutionality in the trial court, but in trial court we won on other issues, and the court didn't get to the constitutional case. So they appealed. So on the first round in appeal, the constitutional issue wasn't in it. They were saying it ought to be reversed, that the trial court was wrong. Then, after the Court of Appeals went with them on their motion for rehearing, appeal, then on motion for rehearing, since we, up to that point, didn't have anything to complain about because the court had dealt with us. But at that point, we then raised in motion for rehearing the question that we had preserved in the trial court. So it was raised in the trial court, but was not argued the first time on appeal. Our thinking being that if the court rules that you're right under the current statute, that you don't then reach the question of constitutionality. Now, the Texas National Guard Armory Board versus McCraw, that's cited in most of the briefs, is typical of all of the cases that say that you look at all of the constitutional provisions and give some weight to all of them, and actually that they should be harmonized if they can. And as I said, this provision of the Constitution is in harmony with the others because there is a method of exercising those Bill of Rights, those provisions of the Bill of Rights. It would be easier for them not to have to go through the problems statewide of an election on amending the Constitution. But that just happens to be the method that the people chose at the time the Constitution was set up for amending it. Now, the Court of Appeals in the Fort Worth case cited State versus Switcher, which is a case that was decided when our state was only a little more than a decade old. And in that case, they pointed out that under the principles of lawmaking, we do it not directly, but through our representatives. Now, they say that this doesn't have anything to do, in their brief, one of the briefs, with lawmaking, because the law is there. But I think what the Fort Worth Court is talking about there is the setting of the tax rate. That is a legislative act on behalf of the Commissioner's Court, and that is done by the Commissioner's Court. Now, in the Waco case, they said county means all of the people of the county. We cited in our brief the constitutional provision that defines who the county is insofar as representing the county is concerned, and of course that is the Commissioner's Court. And then on page 4 of our brief, we quote a part of Article 5, Section 18B, which clearly points out that after saying how the commissioners will be elected and the county judge, and that they will constitute the Commissioner's Court, which shall exercise such powers and jurisdiction over all county business as is conferred by this Constitution and the laws of the state, or as may be hereafter prescribed. Therefore, we think it's the Commissioner's Court who quite properly exercised the responsibility that was placed on it by the Constitution of the State of Texas. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Counsel.
May it please the Court, Mr. Beckett, also an opposite argument on behalf of the District Court of Oklahoma.
May it please the Court, my name is Craig McLaughlin. I'm with the law firm of Perdue, Brandon, and Fielder, who do represent the respondent, Ellis County. I guess my client and myself have been painted as a hard person who says that taxpayer has no right. My argument has been, all the way from trial court to here, is that we have a constitution. It set for certain groundwork, rules which we all agree to follow. That is our basic law, everything that we agree to do. The legislature, by the adoption of Section 26.07, has changed the ground rules. Not by constitutional amendment, but by general law. The point is that our Constitution provides this. I can understand the taxpayer seeing runaway taxes. I can too. But the point is that there is a certain amount of frustration associated with being a democracy. And part of that is getting something changed as our circumstances in which we live and our governing laws need to change with them. They don't happen overnight. Sometimes it takes many, many years. My sole point has been, and the Commissioner's Court of Ellis County, is that the adoption of the so-called rollback provisions flies directly in the face of the two constitutional provisions that authorize the taxes on which the rollbacks are based. Both of them say counties. And I will admit, Section 1A, Article 8, is the weaker of the two taxation provisions. Basically, both of them provide that no county shall adopt a tax for a specified purpose in excess of X amount per hundred. Both provisions have two separate limitations. In the briefs, both of the petitioners state that the whole purpose is limitation on taxation. Our agreement among ourselves have already set that. And if you'll examine Section 9, Article 8, our forefathers, and we inherited this compact among ourselves, they realized that distinction, because in Section 9, there is an additional tax where the taxpayer has the specific right to voice his opinion through an election before that tax is adopted. But the taxes that we are talking about are delegated to the county commissioners as a governing body. The power to tax is a governmental function, legislative in nature. The government code, the Constitution, and cases have dictated that a government or a body in performing governmental functions must be through its duly elected government officials, not the citizens. We have this long, elaborate process. Maybe it's time for change. But the change is through constitutional amendment, not the legislature acting on its own, thinking it's wise. Maybe the legislature never even contemplated this problem. I wasn't there. I don't know. But I think if you will go back, and I think almost everybody in their briefs has stated these constitutional provisions and highlighted the particular portions, that each one of them states the commissioner's court shall adopt this tax and shall remain in effect, and no other constitutional provision shall affect this. And that's the strongest language out of Section 9, Article 8. Section 1A, Article 8, does provide an exception, but that deals with, and it's probably outdated, where we have tax donations for the Road and Bridge Fund. That's the only exception is to their power to tax. And how much?